Very good morning to everyone. Before we begin the call of the day, we have two admissions to the bar. If Susan Lindrup and Ann Ralph would please come to the podium. Judge Rovner and Judge Sykes, I have the honor this morning of moving the admission to the bar of our court of two of my law clerks. First of all, Ms. Susan Lindrup. Ms. Lindrup is a graduate of the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment and of the law school at the University of Notre Dame, where she graduated in 2001. She has practiced law in Washington with the firm of Arnold and Porter. She is admitted to the bar of the District of Columbia and the Commonwealth of Virginia. I also have the honor of moving the admission of Ms. Ann Ralph. Ms. Ralph is a graduated from the University of Notre Dame and received her bachelor's degree in the year 2001, and she received her JD degree from the University of Virginia Law School in the year 2004. And she will be practicing law in the city of Columbus, Ohio. She is a member of the bar of the state of Ohio. So both of them have served this court with distinction throughout this year, and it is my honor to move their admission.
I'm thrilled to be able to join with you.
Well, thank you, and thank you, ladies. If you'll step to the clerk's desk, he will administer the oath.
Thank you.
Our first case for argument this morning is number 03-3868, Maribel R. Galicia against the Attorney General. Ms. Pyrianthopoulos.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Ms. Rodriguez presents numerous issues in this petition for review, including a challenge to an adverse credibility determination that was made for reasons which bear no legitimate nexus to the findings. But this erroneous assessment of Ms. Rodriguez's credibility would not have occurred but for the unfair manner in which Ms. Rodriguez's hearing was conducted by the immigration judge in this matter. It denied her her right under due process to a full and fair hearing.
Before you get any further into your argument, I would like to ask you, the government notes that Ms. Galicia has filed an application for a stay of removal. What's the status of that application?
She applied for administrative relief because of her medical condition. That request was denied.
It has been denied.
Okay. Ms. Rodriguez was prevented from fully presenting her case without any other explanation other than time had evaporated. She was barred from presenting probative expert testimony that would corroborate her claims. Additionally, her own testimony was cut off by the IJ in this matter. As a result of the unfair manner in which the judge handled her case, she was precluded from presenting evidence which would have corroborated her story and provided explanations for perceived inconsistencies in her prior statements. Accordingly, Ms. Rodriguez was the only witness that was permitted to present testimony in this case. And that was severely truncated by the court. In only 52 pages of transcript in the record of her direct testimony, the IJ interrupted the presentation of that evidence at least 37 times. In addition to these constant interruptions, the judge's demeanor severely precluded her counsel from being able to effectively present her case. The judge started the hearing late. He was in a hurry to wrap things up, and as a process, Ms. Rodriguez was denied a fair hearing. This is not the type of situation where an IJ's questioning limited the extent of some testimony, sort of focus on the relevant issues in the case. This is more like the cases Kersiku and Podio of this court, where entire chunks of testimony were excluded as a result of the judge's decisions. Had he allowed the two experts that were prepared to testify in her case, there would have been a lot of evidence in the record that would have lended additional credibility to her claims. One of the experts, Professor Castle, in a declaration that can be found in the record at page 864 of the Consolidated Record on Appeal, outlined several key elements of her claim that his own testimony would have supported. First, he would have testified that Ms. Rodriguez's testimony was consistent with the general, what was generally known to be the activities and modus operandi of the Guatemalan security forces that were persecuting political opponents at the time of the events that she alleged, and political opponents and their families. This was wholly consistent with Mrs. Rodriguez's story at the time of her hearing, at the time of her credible fear interview, and at the time of her airport interview. Second, Professor Castle would have testified that Ms. Rodriguez's response to the violence, intimidation, and the threats that she received in Guatemala were not only typical, but also reasonable for a person living in Guatemala at the time. Her fear was genuine and well-founded. Third, Ms. Rodriguez's initial, he would have explained how Mrs. Rodriguez's initial statements to the government authorities at the airport was very typical of behavior of many Guatemalans whose only experience dealing with their own government officials had been one of repression. Ms. Rodriguez was genuinely in fear that if she communicated certain information to those officials, including her husband's affiliation with the URNG, that she would be subject to further persecution by those officials. And finally, and most importantly, the experts could have elucidated the fact that Ms. Rodriguez continues to face a serious risk of persecution if she's returned to Guatemala, despite what is said in the State Department reports.
What was the IJ's legal basis for excluding the expert testimony?
Initially, he provided no legal basis. He only stated conclusory that he would not permit telephonic testimony by Professor Rothenberg, who was available to testify that morning, and just that time had evaporated, that there was only going to be a limited amount of time. That was the reason that the council made the decision to truncate the presentation of testimony by Ms. Rodriguez so that she would have time to present the testimony of her expert, Professor Castle, who was waiting in the hallway. But when time came to call that additional witness, the judge simply did not allow it because time had evaporated. And the prejudice from this decision by the IJ to not allow the experts to testify is enormous. It's clear from the judge's opinion that he had certain misperceptions about the realities of life in Guatemala. Had the experts been permitted to testify, they could have provided clarification for the judge and in these areas where he had misunderstandings. For example, the IJ pointed out that he found it strange that civilians would pay attention to the license plates of government cars and that they would be observant of these facts when strangers were coming to visit Ms. Rodriguez's home or to visit her at the funeral or at the maternity clinic after she'd given birth to her child. But the experts would have testified that, indeed, license plates are distinguishable, and that Guatemalans very commonly pay attention to these details because of their experiences with police and government authorities in Guatemala. The immigration judge also discounted Ms. Rodriguez's concern about these visits to her home and to the maternity clinic and to the funeral. He thought their behavior was an innocuous attempt, explainable as a normal investigatory practice of someone investigating a crime. But had Professor Castle been permitted to testify, he would have explained, and he explains this in his declaration in the record, that underpaid Guatemalan police officials rarely conduct these types of investigations in the dead of night. The hallmarks of government officials who are making these visits for the purpose of intimidation, and they're doing so under the cover of darkness. So for these reasons, it's significant that the expert testimony was precluded in this case because it clearly resulted in prejudice to Ms. Rodriguez.
Now, Ms. Marianthopoulos, I understand that the claimant raised her health and the hardship on her children in her motion to reopen.
That's right.
But did she raise these in relation to her persecution claim? She seems to have raised them as new and independent grounds rather than in relation to the persecution claim.
I believe in her motion to reopen, she raised these as new facts that would have bared an impact on her well-founded fear of persecution if returned to Guatemala. And I believe that was sufficient to preserve the issue on appeal before this court.
Would the hardship on her children have been a new and independent ground?
Her U.S. citizen child, who was born after, would be new. Her other two children would be an issue not presented to the IJ, but not a new fact.
And the illness, was that a new?
The illness was new. It was diagnosed, I believe, in 2000.
Okay.
And it was only in 2002 when she learned it was incurable. So it's notable that the Guatemalan security forces came after Ms. Rodriguez at times where she was particularly vulnerable, such as at her husband's funeral and at the maternity clinic after she gave birth. Now Ms. Rodriguez is even more vulnerable. If she's returned to Guatemala, she will be in a position where she relies on the government to sustain her life.
The elephant in the room in this whole situation is, however, she has returned at least once to Guatemala of her own volition. For someone who has a well-founded fear of persecution, it seems very strange that she would risk doing that, especially when there was another member of the family who could have made the trip in her place and who apparently did not carry the same baggage as she did in terms of hatred by the local authorities.
Your Honor, there are times in one's life, such as the death of a parent, where emotion overtakes reason. And what is in the record is that when she did return for this limited purpose for her father's funeral, she traveled under an assumed name. She remained in hiding in the entire time she was in the country, and she left within a very short time. It wasn't an extended vacation or any other purpose. It was clear that she was going there for the purpose of the funeral, and then she was trying to get back to the United States as quickly as possible. There are just times where emotion overtakes reason. And if she does return to Guatemala now, the circumstances are entirely different. This condition, I mean, this is a dying woman who will require dialysis on a daily basis to survive. She will no longer have the ability to hide from the government when she returns to Guatemala. Turning to the credibility determination of the judge, which was clearly flawed, for reasons that I've explained before regarding the barring of the expert testimony. If you look at the three reasons the judge used to not believe that Ms. Rodriguez was a victim of past persecution, you'll find that none of them are supported by the evidence. The first reason that her statements were contradictory in her airport interview, they weren't contradictory, they were incomplete. The second reason that she failed to produce the car registration, this woman produced numerous other documentary evidence, such as the death certificates of her husband, her uncle, and the affidavit of a doctor who treated her for anxiety attacks twice in July of 95 after she received threats. And finally, the fact that she gave a false name and lied about the location of her children in her airport interview, these are immaterial inconsistencies that cannot be the basis of adverse credibility determination. And for these reasons alone, the fundamentally unfair hearing and the unsupported credibility finding, this case should be remanded for a new hearing. I reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Marianthopoulos.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Fraser.
Good morning. I would like to begin, if I could, with counsel's first argument, first allegation that the immigration judge conducted the hearing in an unfair manner and that she was prevented from fully presenting her case and expert testimony and from producing corroboration, that her hearing was truncated. I think it's the notion that after having undergone an airport interview at the conclusion of which she was asked if she had anything else she wanted to say, that she then underwent a credible fear interview at the conclusion of which she was asked if she had anything else she wanted to say, that she submitted an asylum application and attached a declaration in which she could say anything she wanted to say, and that she then underwent a hearing represented by counsel at which counsel was on numerous occasions asked, is there anything else that you would want to say, belies the claim that she was prevented from fully and fairly presenting her case. I would add also that, and it's unusual in immigration cases, she submitted a 25-page hearing memorandum to the immigration judge in which she was allowed to say anything that she wanted to say. Neither of the experts, Professor Rothenberg or Professor Cassell, could have addressed the adverse credibility findings by the immigration judge when you consider what the nature of those findings were. And it's not correct to suggest, as counsel has, that their evidence was excluded. At the end of the hearing, the immigration judge permitted offers of proof. Professor Rothenberg, I believe, submitted a 12-page affidavit. Professor Cassell had an equal opportunity to submit a written affidavit as an offer of proof, but for whatever reason decided not to do so. Those are part of the record, in addition to the oral offers of proof made by counsel during the hearing. They're part of the record. They were considered by the immigration judge, so it's not correct to say that they were excluded.
What evidence is there that they were considered by the immigration judge? They were offered by way of offer of proof only to preserve
They're part of the record, Your Honor. I cannot remember off the top of my head whether they're mentioned in the immigration judge's decision.
Are you conceding that it was error to exclude those experts' live testimony?
No, I'm certainly not. I'm saying we don't know what else they would have said. It's not suggested what they might have said in oral testimony that's not contained either in the offer of proof or in the written declaration, so I'm not conceding at all that it was error.
Well, that goes to prejudice. What was the reason for excluding their live testimony?
Of the experts?
And the legal basis for doing that?
I don't know what the legal basis was, but the immigration judge had indicated ahead of time that he wanted to conclude the hearing on that day, that he was not going to continue it on a second day. And that's why there was a point at which counsel asked if he could ask a few more questions. The immigration judge said, yes, you can, but bear in mind, I'm going to conclude this hearing today. And so, in other words, if you want to take up the time remaining to you through examination of Ms. Rodriguez, go right ahead, but that's going to bear on your right to present expert testimony.
Was that before or after the testimony of the experts was excluded?
That was before. The testimony wasn't excluded, Your Honor. The judge said he wasn't going to permit. I don't think it's accurate to say that it was excluded. That suggests that he considered what they had to say and found it not relevant or not germane. This happened at the end. My recollection is that it happened at the end of the hearing. when he said, make offers of proof, we've run out of time.
I have to tell you, Mr. Fraser, maybe you can help me with this. I'm terribly troubled about, some of the assumptions the IJ made without any basis in the record. To me, he almost seemed to be putting a Chicago spin on things. For example, he seems to assume that the police came to the funeral or to the maternity ward at 1 a.m. Looking for the claimant because they were there to work on her husband's murder. And he seems to think that one can obtain a duplicate car registration in Guatemala as easily as someone can walk over to the Secretary of State's office in Chicago. What do we do with his assumptions that the government of Guatemala was honest and efficient at a time when we all know, we can almost take judicial notice of the fact that it wasn't?
Let me start with the second point first. What troubled the immigration judge the most about the car registration is that there was no attempt to explain an inability to produce either a duplicate or, well, for example, Ms. Rodriguez testified that five of her six sisters live in Guatemala, her mother and her brother, but she didn't say that she contacted any of them to even attempt to obtain a duplicate of the car registration or her driver's license or any other proof of ownership of the car. That's the corroboration point.
But isn't it a tremendous possibility that she is fearful of bringing her family into a situation when things may be fine for them?
Are you asking, might it be reasonable for her to say, I don't want to put my family at risk?
In jeopardy, sure.
At risk, if she had made that claim, yes. If she had used that, if she had explained, I didn't try to obtain a copy because I don't want to put my family at risk, then it might have been reasonable, and the immigration judge might have considered that. But the argument wasn't presented to him, so he didn't have the opportunity.
You know, the IJ ruled that the telephonic death threats were not severe enough to constitute persecution. Let me tell you, as someone who receives those, let's assume for a moment that the claimant's husband and uncle were murdered by the government and the claimant then received death threats from someone saying they intended to kill her the way they killed her husband. Would the government seriously take the position that those threats don't constitute persecution as a matter of law?
Never as a matter of law. As a matter of fact, perhaps, but we would ask that you consider the totality of the circumstances. And the circumstances in this case, in fact, was that there was one telephonic death threat, and Ms. Rodriguez, which is, I believe, took place while she was living with her in-laws, and the fact that she continued to live with her in-laws and expose herself to more threats for 3 to 4 months before she then went to live with her uncle for 9 months, during which time she received no threats whatsoever. So it has to be taken, I would propose, Your Honor, in the context of the allegations of this case. Might there be circumstances? Yes.
Let us talk about the airport interview just for an instant.
Thank you.
The brief argues that the IJ did not use the claimant's airport interview statements as a basis for his adverse credibility determination. But if we read from the decision at page 7, what it says is, these statements, though they do not undercut the central elements of her asylum claim in themselves, or a further demonstration that the respondent is willing to lie in order to avoid the consequences of her actions. He certainly seems to be using her airport interview statements against her. I mean, how else could we read that?
I think what he meant, Your Honor, is that he didn't point to any specific statement in the interview and say, you contradicted yourself, as he did, for example, with the subsequent credible fear interview. But I think what he's considering is the fact that she indicated, Ms. Rodriguez testified, that she didn't apply for asylum because she wasn't aware that asylum was available in the United States. But when you look at the airport interview, it was explained to her, U.S. law provides protection to certain persons who face persecution or torture. If you fear or have a concern about being removed from the United States or about being sent home, you should tell me so during this interview because you may not have another chance. Do you understand what I have said to you? And she says, yes. I think it's reasonable for the immigration judge, even if he isn't going to look at why did you come here because I was looking for work, and not utilize that as an inconsistency or a contradiction, but to point to that very clear offer of an opportunity to her and the fact and her contrary testimony to say that is part of his general indirect perhaps. Credibility determination.
Does the government dispute as a factual matter that a return to Guatemala would likely result in her death because of her medical condition?
Yes, we do, Your Honor, because I don't recall seeing anywhere in the record. Let me back up. I believe at one point there was the Department of Health was brought in to make an inquiry. I don't know what the results of that were. But my recollection of the record is that it does not say, for example, that it is impossible to obtain kidney dialysis in Guatemala. And what we have are doctors in the United States saying they don't think that she could obtain a kidney transplant in Guatemala. So I think there are unanswered questions about that, to be honest with you. And I'm not suggesting that she's likely to receive necessarily the same health care, but I believe that there are some ambiguity and some unanswered questions that would prevent me from saying absolutely one way or another. The next point, if I may, is to address the motion to reopen. There is some conflict as to what exactly the basis of our argument is. The motion to, and I think there needs to be some clarification as to what exactly the basis of the motion to reopen was. If you look at it carefully, it presents arguments that track a motion that might be made for an applicant for cancellation of removal under 8 U.S.C. 1229B. Cancellation of removal, among other things, requires that you demonstrate hardship to a U.S. citizen spouse or child and good moral character. The motion to reopen addresses both of those factors. The problem is that neither of them is a factor in granting asylum. And that's why when the BIA denied the motion to reopen, among other things, it gave Ms. Rodriguez the benefit of the doubt and said, even if you intended to move to reopen to apply for cancellation of removal, you're not eligible because you don't satisfy the 10-year continuous physical presence requirement. So what that leaves us with is a motion to reopen an asylum case based on changed circumstances. And it presented two changed circumstances, which is required by regulation. What it doesn't do is address the additional regulatory requirement of materiality. That additional regulatory requirement of materiality, we argue, was presented for the first time in the Ms. Rodriguez brief to this court, and that's what triggers the failure to exhaust requirement. Let me go, if I may, briefly to the adverse credibility finding, because the fact of the matter is that's probably the most important issue in this case. If you find that the adverse credibility finding is supported by substantial evidence, then that resolves all issues, including the motion to reopen, because the motion to reopen doesn't address the adverse credibility finding in any way. We submit that the immigration judge's finding was submitted by substantial evidence. Ms. Rodriguez's credible fear interview indicates that she stated clearly that her husband was not had no political involvement, did not belong to any groups, was not active in politics, and did not have any party membership. There was no mention in her credible fear interview of the URNG guerrilla group at all, and she claimed that she did not know who was responsible for the death of her husband and uncle or why they were killed, and she didn't know and she did not know, and this is important, she did not know what he and his friends talked about. During her hearing, she claimed that her husband was an active member of the URNG, and then she, and in her asylum declaration, she talks about the use of her car to bring supplies and food and medical supplies to the guerrillas. The second issue goes to the Huelga de Dolores annual demonstration. In the Credible Fear interview, Ms. Rodriguez said she did not know whether her husband personally participated, and she claimed that she did not know why the police would want to follow and kill her husband based on his indirect involvement. During her hearing, however, she claimed that her husband was an active participant. The immigration judge found that her attempt to connect the killing of her husband with purported political activities was a strategy of recent vintage. And in fact, if you track the various steps in her case, that finding is certainly justified.
Counsel, doesn't the documentary evidence about the manner of her husband's death and her uncle's death completely overcome whatever inconsistencies there were between her airport interview and her hearing testimony?
It's not the manner of his death that's at issue. It's whether who killed him and whether there was a political motivation and how that pertains to her.
Right, but the experts who were not allowed to testify would have corroborated the physical evidence of their torture and murders as the work of Guatemalan security agents.
And I believe that the Rothenberg affidavit, which is part of the record, did do so, Your Honor.
But the IJ completely discounted that and said they don't have personal knowledge of these two particular murders, so he wasn't going to consider
it. The question is, how was the question from asylum purposes is not whether he was killed or how he was killed. It's what how that relates to her. How she says that relates to her. And I'll quote you briefly because, well, I won't because I know my time is running out. But she said, the security forces found my registration in the car that was found at the scene of death. That's how they tracked me down. That is the linkage that her asylum case depends upon. The expert testimony would have had no bearing on that linkage. That's her claim. And I see that my time is up. I thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Fraser. Ms. Miranthopoulos, you have 2 minutes.
Just a few quick points, Your Honor. On the issue of the car registration, she did explain that it had been missing, but it's not a necessary piece of evidence in her case to support her claims. There is an abundance of evidence in this case that shows she was, in fact, targeted. She received threats, and those threats included the threat to kill her. She, at her airport interview, never claimed her husband was a member of the URNG, but she never claimed that at the hearing either. She said he provided support to them, and she did provide lots of information at the airport interview, which was consistent with her later testimony, that her husband was involved with university students in protest, involved in political demonstrations, that he was murdered by the police, and that he was tortured, and that she was persecuted by them. So I think there's really nothing inconsistent in her prior testimony at the airport. It was just an incomplete recitation of the facts. I think counsel confuses the timing of the airport interview. When she was detained in 97 at the airport, she did apply for asylum once she was informed of that option. The first time she came to this country was under a tourist visa, and when she was living here prior to returning for her father's funeral, she was not aware that asylum was an option for a person like her. Judge Rovner inquired as to the ability to obtain a medical care in Guatemala. Council has contacted a doctor in Guatemala and provided his affidavit to the BIA as part of our motion to reissue and redate the opinion, and that doctor confirms that this woman would not be able to obtain adequate medical care in Guatemala. And finally, it's clear from the record that the judge discounted any potential testimony the experts could have provided. In his opinion, he says, neither of these witnesses had specific knowledge about the respondents or the events she described, and it's clear that he did not take their opinions into consideration. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Indeed, our thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.